Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we'll sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking with Diego Sanchez. Diego, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Tim, thank you for asking me.
Well, let's talk about your work a little bit. How'd you get started on this path as an artist?
That's interesting. As you know, I don't know if you know this or not, Tim, but I was born in Bogota, Colombia. Uh-huh. And my father was a judge. And as you know, the political situation in Colombia has been delicate for the past 25 years or so.
Delicate's a polite way of putting it.
So we decided, my father decided, there were a couple people who requested that he rule in their favor in a case, and he said no. And so they told him that he should be careful with his family, and so he decided that was a good time for us to move.
When was this?
This was around 1979. So
these were, I'm assuming these were cartel, drug related.
Yeah, unofficially they were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
they weren't coming up to you and saying, hi, we're the drug cartel and rule. Yeah.
But if somebody tells you that you should be careful with your family and you take that seriously.
That's a huge change.
So
in 1979, how old were you?
Well, we actually arrived in the States in 1980 I remember my father came one day and said, okay, we're going to be moving in about a month. My mom's family had been here in the States, so they were able to help us at first.
And,
I'm very grateful because we didn't have any problem getting papers or anything like that. So we arrived here in the summer of 1980, I remember that because the Iran-Contra affair was going on.
Right. How old were you?
I was 17. Okay. I was a junior in high school.
Do you speak English?
No, in Colombia, you get a choice to study French or English, and I love French.
Wow.
So I came here and...
Speaking French and Spanish.
Yeah, I knew how to say pencil and the numbers, but it was...
More paper.
Yes.
Paint.
It was tough.
Yeah.
And actually, I didn't know I was going to be an artist.
When did that start for you?
The first time I took an art class was in high school. The educational system in Colombia is very different from the educational system in the States. You don't have as many choices. You're required to take algebra, calculus, philosophy before you graduate. It's almost like a junior college. So all my credits transfer. So the only thing that I had to take was English, U.S. history, U.S. government, and then I had a free period and I could take an art class. So the first year, actually, I was studying English for the first half of the day, and then the other half I was studying English and U.S. history and U.S. government.
Right.
And my senior year, I was able to take an art class and just change my life.
Really? How? What happened?
Well, my mom was a nurse, and she used to work with homeless children in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really had a great deal of respect for how many lives she touched. And that's what I was going to do. I was going to study medicine and work with poor people. But being here...
Work with what people?
With poor.
Oh, with poor people.
People in Colombia. Yeah. But
you wanted to study medicine to become a doctor.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when I fell in love with drawing and I told my parents that I was thinking about becoming an artist, they were not, ecstatic about the news, but they were very supportive.
They were.
They never told me, don't do this. They were not happy about it, but they were.
Because of the same reason everybody. I mean, how are you going to make a living?
Most of the immigrants, when they come here, they want their kids to study, law or medicine or something that they're going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There's not much money in the arts, as you know.
You found that out, huh? Yeah, I know.
But, so I...
So was it a drawing teacher or just the drawing? I mean, you hadn't been a kid who had done a lot of drawing or anything like that?
No. I went to the store to buy some gum and some cigarettes. I used to smoke a long time ago. And the woman behind the counter couldn't understand what I was saying.
Right.
And there was a whole bunch of people behind me, and it was very frustrating, very frustrating experience. So I remember just pointing to the cigarettes and going home and getting a piece of paper and a pencil and just kind of letting all this kind of rage come out.
Really? Do you remember what you drew?
No, it was just kind of, you know, it was just a bunch of lines, but kind of frustration.
Uh-huh.
And imagine a drawing that represents frustration and anger. That's what I was just kind of letting things out. And it kind of dawned on me, you know, if I become an artist, I don't have to speak English or French or whatever. If I have a good drawing, I can communicate that to anybody who's looking at it.
Interesting story.
So that's how I decided to become an artist.
And from there, where did you go? I mean,
well, from there, since my parents didn't have any money, I mean, we went from being upper middle class.
Yeah, I was going to say, upper middle class in Bogota,
My father had, you know, he was pretty well off. We had a very nice house, and he put a lot of the money in the stock market, thinking that he was going to make a lot of money so we could come here and, you know, buy a house and things like that. Unfortunately, he lost a lot of money, almost everything.
Really?
So we went from an upper middle class there, you know, where we had two maids at home to have absolutely nothing here.
Really?
So that was a really...
Where did you live?
Well, we lived with one of my uncles in Falls Church at first. And then we lived in a trailer for a little while until, you know, I finished high school. I was the first one to get a job in my family. And
so your father wasn't able to work?
Well, he couldn't speak English.
Oh. It's a shame it's not now. They could use Spanish speaking judges now, but not then.
So, you know, after I finished high school, I had a friend of mine who was in the Army. He said, you know, if you join the Army Reserve, they can help you pay for your school.
Uh-huh.
So I was in the Army for 6 years.
Really?
And they pay for my undergraduate school.
Where'd you go?
As an undergraduate?
Yeah.
Well, I started at a community college, Northern Virginia Community College. I got a degree in commercial art, illustration, trying to compromise.
Right.
And
the old compromise?
And it didn't work. I hate it. I worked for a company for a year, and I was basically executing the art director's ideas.
Yeah.
So it got kind of old, and I decided to, you know, I kept hearing about VCU, and I decided just to come and visit and walk through the Pollock Building, third floor, and I saw these wonderful paintings, and I said, you know, I have to come here. So I came here, finished my undergraduate degree in 2 years, and then I applied to graduate school and got in and finished graduate school in 2000, and here I am.
So the passion was strong enough, the love of it was strong enough to override, you know, the immigrant son, the expectation of doing well, the... You know, come to this country, all of the capitalism in this country, all of the emphasis on professional success. I mean, you're willing to roll the dice on all of that? Or were you even thinking about that at that age?
I always felt a little guilty.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I send money to my parents and my mom every month when I could. I did. I still tried to help them out whenever I can.
Right.
And the great thing about my family, my brothers, is the fact that, you know, Hispanic family, they are very together and they help each other. And my other two brothers are very, I'm not very good with money and and finances. And my other two brothers actually have a degree in business, so they have done very well. They worked together for 12 years and they pay off a house where my mom lives, so she's living there rent-free.
Wow.
So it's pretty, you know, we try to help each other whenever we can.
Yeah. That's very different than our culture. I mean, it's funny, you know, who was I talking to? Somebody from another country. And we were talking, I was up in D.C. and I was meeting with a bunch of folks. And this guy was from, might have been Italy, I can't remember. But he was really shocked about the whole thing about, you know, because I just said, you know, when my son turned 19, you know, and moved out, that I said jokingly, you know, we changed the locks. And he just, his mouth fell. And he said, you did what? And I said, well, we changed the locks. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I was ready for him to go. And he says, it's not that way in our country, you know. And it's not that way in many, many, many countries.
It's not. I mean, usually it's kind of funny. You stay with your parents until you get married, mm-hmm. especially women.
Yeah.
They stay with the parents until you get married.
Right.
And also the way that we treat the elderly is very different. You know, it's an honor for you to take care of your grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the grandparents stay with us.
So how is all of this, let's talk about your painting a little. How has all of this affected your painting? I mean, obviously your whole point of reference is different than, you know, some white middle-class kid who grew up in, you know, Poughkeepsie.
Well, my painting has changed a great deal. You know, the first few years when I was in school, and shortly thereafter, the first 4 or 5 years, my work was very political. I was very concerned mm-hmm. about the political situation in Latin America. So my work was dealing
specifically,
with...
Specifically, what were you...
Specifically, the fact that the poor people in Central and South America were being trapped between... the government and the military and guerrilla fighters.
Yes, okay.
So they get trapped in the middle.
Right.
And
right, so the guerrillas would come in and they would say, you have to support us, you have to be a part of this, and if you're not, we're going to come back and kill you.
Right.
And the government would come in an hour later and say, you've got to be part of the government, and if you don't support us, we're going to kill you.
That's right.
So, yeah.
That's right.
So just a nightmare for the folks caught in the middle.
So I did a lot of, you know, political paintings, and then I was dealing with my identity. I was trying to figure out, because you reach a point when you live in a country that is, you know, another mm-hmm. country where you were born, where you kind of question whether you're Colombian or American, and
right.
you know, I was trying to figure out, because I went back home, and when I went back home, it's almost like I felt like a foreigner again.
Really?
Because everything had changed so much. It's very interesting how your memories don't age.
Yeah.
You know, all my friends and everything was so different when I went back home, and I felt, you know, I didn't
like
feel
an
like
outsider.
I was, yes. Yeah. Once again, for the second time in my life, I was an outsider in Colombia and the country where I was born.
That affect your art?
Yeah. I went through a period where I was questioning my identity, who I was, where I was coming from. But I think, you know, something that every artist goes through,
mm-hmm.
you know, questioning what you're doing. We just do it differently.
Yeah.
Depending on what you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, but you were questioning your identity. What does that really mean? I mean.
Well, I felt for a long time that I was not a Colombian or an American. And I came to terms with this feeling by taking the best out of the two cultures.
Uh-huh.
You know, I feel like I'm bicultural in a way.
Yeah, I mean. It's hard for me to understand. I hope you understand that. But, you know, it's hard. But there really was a real tangible sense of alienation.
Yes. Yeah.
And of not belonging.
Yeah, but yes. And, you know, it really, there's a lot of things that are wonderful about the United States that most people take for granted. Most Americans take for granted.
Right.
I mean, I was able to put myself through school, buy a house. With absolutely no money at all.
Right.
You can do this in other places in the world.
Right.
You know, and most people take all this for granted.
Yeah. Well, we take a lot for granted.
Yeah.
I mean, health, you know. I mean, of course, there are 46 million of us that can't get it, or at least don't have health insurance. They can get some treatment. But so there are ups and downs.
Yes.
You know, in terms of our culture. But I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So... Go ahead.
I mean, I had some friends who were brilliant in Colombia, and unless you know the right people and you have the right connections, you can get into the universities.
Wow.
It doesn't matter, you know, if you...
How smart you are.
Yeah,
it was who you knew.
Yeah.
Wow. So, what kind of work do you do?
Right now, I always love materials, so my process has changed gradually. The way that I usually work, I work on panels. I've been working on panels for the past 7 years or so.
So like wood panels, like Luan?
Yes.
Yes.
Masonite, tempered Masonite.
Mm-hmm.
I usually sand the panels and prime them with gesso. I usually 3 to 5 coat sanding in between coats, so you end up with a beautiful, smooth surface.
Why that as opposed to canvas or...
I'm pretty aggressive with my surfaces. I like to scratch and scrape. And, you know, I really like a hard surface to work against.
Uh-huh.
Canvas has this give.
Yeah.
So it's really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I enjoy canvas, but it's not, I mean, I can be more aggressive and more with the panels.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I use. Anyway, after I prime the canvas, I mean, the panels, what I usually do, start applying colors and wiping things and sanding things, kind of creating a feel without knowing what is going to happen.
So is it intuitive at this point?
Yes. Yes. It's completely intuitive. I react to shapes, colors.
Is it ever scary? Is it?
No, because I have no expectations whatsoever.
Okay.
And then I usually...
So you're playing.
Yes.
Not like a child play, in the most sophisticated sense of play.
Yes.
Okay.
What I usually do, you know, I keep telling my students that, you know, making art really is like exercising. You have to stretch. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling my students that the most important thing they have to do if they want to become proficient and be good artists, they have to draw a great deal. So I encourage them to draw at least 10 to 15 minutes every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I have at
home. Why do you think that?
It's a discipline. I mean, keep your eyes sharp and your mind sharp. And when you're drawing or painting, you're really seeing things. You have to contemplate and you have to concentrate.
Right.
You know, it's almost like an intellectual activity that requires your attention.
Yes.
And you can become very sloppy if you don't keep it up.
Right. And so you see that as a part of the discipline. I'm thinking about painters who can't draw, for instance.
Yes, I think.
You know.
Yeah, I see it as a discipline.
Right.
And, you know, the first drawings that I do, I have a sketchbook in my studio that I use the first 5 minutes that I draw. And it's a sketchbook of bad drawings. And everything that I do there for the first 5 minutes is terrible.
Right.
So, you know, this kind of takes the pressure off. So I know that this is my sketchbook of bad drawings, so I just loosen up.
Ah, so you have a ritual like that.
Yes.
So you go in the studio and you do your sketchbook of bad drawings.
Yes.
Ah, interesting. Interesting.
And that's
how you cope with getting in there.
Yes.
Okay.
And I also have a book of stains where I keep clean my brushes. Mm-hmm. So I have this sketchbook with all these wonderful stains and varnishes and, you know, marks.
Right.
And, you know, every time that I clean my brushes, I use a different page. So I have all these wonderful stains that I respond to it. And sometimes I make drawings on top of those stains. And that's, you know, I'm always trying to figure out a nice combination of colors or shapes and that is going to be a ground for my paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, after I develop a ground that I like, I come back and I paint something, an object that I respond to.
So
usually a single object. For instance, a couple of summers ago, I went to Maine I developed an infatuation with canoes. And boats. And I've been doing a lot of drawings of canoes, and it's just such a wonderful vessel. I love the shape. So I've been drawing canoes on top of the stains, and, you know, that's what I'm working on right now.
It's interesting. I was talking to Lewis Poole the other day, and who you know, and is a painter, and, you know, and he does houses. I mean, his thing is houses. And I said, so it kind of sounds like you've sort of fallen in love with houses, you know. He said, well, I don't know if I'd put it that way, but I think you do sort of fall in love as an artist with shapes, with certain things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and you kind
of... So that's your subject matter now?
It's
You've
part
gone
of
from
it.
Colosseums to canoes?
Well, I have different things that I like. I'm working right now on 4 or 5 different series.
Uh-huh.
I usually, when I create a painting, I don't usually just create one painting, but I usually make 3 or 4 paintings that are related to that subject matter.
At the same time?
Yes.
Why?
It just kind of helps me think. If I run into problems, I put up a painting, I look at it, and work on the next painting, and they kind of help each other.
What kind of problems do you run into as a painter? And I'm asking from not a, you know, obviously painters out there know, well, but other people, it's like, what do you mean you run into problems painting?
Well,
what does that mean?
Sometimes, you know, the way that I approach my work is purely intuitive. And then after you make a mark or you create a shape or you apply a color, you step back and you look at it, and then intellectually you know whether or not that is working or not.
Okay.
And you can...
So
it's hard to explain unless you see it.
It's a back and forth process.
Yes.
So it's subjective, objective.
Yes. It's almost like constructing and deconstructing at the same time.
Right,
and
right.
It's kind of a pull and push, give and take kind of relationship. So you make a mark and then you respond to the mark.
Right.
And then you know... You know, sometimes it's hard to know when to stop. And I have ruined many paintings. And, you know,
really?
Yeah. And I think what is really important and something that I try to encourage my students to do is to not be afraid to push the work far enough. It's much better to ruin a painting instead of not pushing it far enough.
Why?
Because I think what is very important and what is very significant is what you learn from making. You know, I mean, I remember.
What do you learn from making?
Well, I'll give you an. you know, my the way that I approached painting changed about 7 years ago. The Virginia Museum had a wonderful exhibition on art from Tibet.
Right.
And part of the exhibition were these monks who came and chanted every day, and they created this beautiful sand painting.
I remember
mandala.
That. Yes.
You know, they worked for 3 hours every day, and people were encouraged to come and watch them.
Right.
And, you know, they work on this thing for about a month. And I remember having coffee one day before I went to the studio, and there was an article about them and the fact that when they're finished, they took the painting and dumped it in the James River.
Right.
And to me, that was just kind of mind-blowing. It's, you know, how can you work on something for such a long time and then destroy it?
And it was beautiful.
And it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And it dawned on me that what it was really important for them was the act of being together, working on something together,
right.
learning. And uh-huh. the act of doing was more important than the final product.
When you're done with a piece, are you done with it?
I'm never done with a piece. And one of the things that drives my wife crazy is the fact that when I have paintings in my studio, I paint over them.
Right.
You know, I always wonder what happens if I change a color here or a shape there, and I always end up painting over them.
Really?
Yeah.
So you got to get in there and get them out of your studio before you paint.
So I never have paintings available because I'm always painting on top of my paintings.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's very interesting.
So what I try to do when I have a show, I work on them and then get it out of my studio so I don't see them anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh. So that when they're out of your, I mean, what's more important to you, the end product or the process?
The process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The process is
Can you articulate what you learned from painting?
It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
But basically, there is such a joy and there's such a feeling of, I don't know, it's like this is what you were meant to be doing.
Right.
And you lose completely a sense of time and uh-huh. you don't worry about anything. You're just there with the painting. You're creating and destroying. And there's this relationship that happens and you just kind of completely get lost in it.
Does it ever feel selfish?
Sometimes it does feel selfish because, you know, you could be spending time with your significant others, and but it's just something that you know, that I have to do.
Yeah.
It's just really important, and I'm very happy when I do it.
Have you ever had a time period where you didn't paint?
When there was a month after my father died where I was completely, my father retired, and then a month later he found out he had cancer and die in mm-hmm. like 20 days.
Wow.
So after he died, I found myself one time in my studio with all the work that I had created in graduate school and, you know, a couple of years worth of work, paintings everywhere, and I couldn't make anything. It was just really mm-hmm. painful to be there, and mm-hmm. everything seemed so, I don't know, it seems like I needed room to clean. So I remember mm-hmm. taking all my work to a field, and I just burned everything. Got rid of everything.
Really?
And one of the things that I regret a great deal is I was working on these beautiful drawings. I decided to do 100 little drawings, black and white drawings, and I didn't document them or anything. So that's the only thing that I regret, you know, burning. But, you know, it's almost like plowing a field. You know, you cultivate this field and you take from it and then...
Yeah, what came from the burning? I mean, was it similar to the... It wasn't at all the same as a Buddhist monk thing.
No, it was kind of a cleansing. It's like starting new with a fresh page, getting rid of things and moving on.
That these things had too much attachment to the past, and the past was painful right now.
Yeah. I just wanted to, you know, start fresh.
How'd you feel when they were burning? Did you feel mixed?
Well, I remember I was thinking about what my wife was going to say when I got home. that was what I was thinking about.
Right.
And then...
You did what?
And then, you know, there was this whole sense of relief. You know, I wasn't sad about him.
Really?
It was just, you know, now I can start again.
Yeah.
Make more. Thanks.
Interesting. Really interesting. So talk a little bit. Do you have any shows around now?
I just had a show at Plan Zero at the mm-hmm. beginning of the year, and it was, you know, it did very well. I just had a couple pieces at the 1708 Small Work Show, and they did very well. I had a painting or have a painting at the Page Bond Gallery now, and that's all.
Oh, are you in that show too?
I was in the show, yeah.
Okay, great. Or is that a different show? There's a Christmas show now.
That is the
big
show.
Works. Is that the one?
That's the one.
Okay, great.
I think Lewis has a piece there too.
Right.
It's a beautiful gallery. Mm-hmm. Nice gallery. But I have a big show coming up. I have a friend of mine who is the head of the art program at Woodbury Forest. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to have if I can have a show there. And I said, sure. And I was asking him about, you know, how many paintings do I need? Apparently, the gallery there is quite large. So he told me about 40 large paintings.
I'm sorry, 40?
Yes. So I told him, you know, there's no way I can have 40 large paintings in 15 months. So I'm going to...
Especially since you paint over your paintings.
That's right. Especially since I don't have any paintings.
I have to give you 2 days on each painting and then snatch it out of there, you know.
So I'm going to be having a show with a good friend of mine, Jorge Benitez, who's so we'll be kind of a Hispanic, you know, the Hispanic connection there.
Right.
But Jorge is a wonderful painter.
Yeah.
I'm very happy for him. The museum just purchased one of his drawings.
They did?
Yes.
Oh, great.
And also we were together in a show at Capital One and they bought two of his paintings. So he's doing very well.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good, good. Yeah. He's a pretty special guy.
He's wonderful. Very bright, eloquent. Yeah. And
Yeah. That's great. Well, I'm afraid we're just about out of time here.
Thank you very much for lunch. I left my sandwich.
Sure. You eat very silently. I'm sorry we had to put it in a Mixmaster. but fantasy is good. Fantasy is good. It keeps you alive. What's something you would say to your students about making art? What's something you...
You know, something that I tell my students about life in general is the first thing is make sure that you don't waste time. You know, I think the older that I'm getting, the more I realize how little time I have.
Yeah.
So I realize what is really important. And, you know, we waste so much time with nitpicking things and getting into politics that are really not worthwhile, you know, at work and things like that. But really just really do what you love to do and don't waste any time. Just kind of go for it.
Yeah, it's good advice. Okay. Well, thank you, Diego. And I want to thank you folks for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you again on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.